coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Lawmakers have introduced a bill to change Delaware's Coastal Zone Act with an eye towards spurring economic development on the first state's shoreline.
I wanted to be able to thread the needle between creating some jobs in the coastal zone, but also protecting our pristine coastline.
But does the bill actually do that? We lay out both sides of the debate this week. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in on the state of charter schools in Wilmington, hear about Newcastle County's plan to attack crime by addressing vacant housing, and explain how your visit to the beaches in Rehoboth will be a little different this summer. Plus, we meet some Middletown students whose experiment heads to space next week. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Since it was passed in 1971, Delaware's Coastal Zone Act has been a bulwark against development of any kind by heavy industry along the first state's coastline, with the goal of protecting and preserving that sensitive natural resource. But in recent years, economic pressures have led some to suggest making changes to that landmark legislation in the name of needed economic development. And earlier this year, Governor John Carney turned those suggestions into a policy priority by announcing his support for pursuing changes to the CZA in his first speech to the General Assembly in March. Carney conceded then, and many lawmakers on both sides of the aisle agree, tweaking the CZA is a heavy lift that requires threading the needle between making changes that will draw development while satisfying concerned environmental interests. Well, a bill to open up Delaware's coastal zone has now been introduced at Legislative Hall. What does it do, and does it thread that needle? Those are questions contributor John Hurdle addresses in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joins us now to guide us through what he found. John, thanks for joining us this week.
Hi, Tom.
Well, let's start with the bill itself. It's not a complete overhaul of the Coastal Zone Act, so what exactly does it do?
Well, what it does is that it takes the 14 sites that were industrial sites, that were industrial sites, active sites, when the original Coastal Zone Act became law in 1971. And it creates a mechanism whereby investors, industrial developers can apply for permits to allow, once again, those sites to become used for industrial purposes. And all but one of the sites is in Newcastle County. They represent actually quite only about 2% of the total coastal zone, which spreads throughout the coast of Delaware. Of course, the original purpose of the Act was to preserve that area for recreation and tourism. And what the current bill is trying to do is to strike a balance between reactivating these sites in the hope that they're going to attract investment and badly needed jobs, whilst at the same time protecting the environment in keeping with the original intent of the Act.
Now, you visited one of these targeted sites, the old Claymont Steel site. Some plans have been offered for redeveloping portions of that site. Is the suggestion here that any plans for that site or others like it can't really get off the ground without lifting CZA restrictions?
Well, what the backers of the bill say is that there is a certain amount, there is remediation going on at present at that site, in the Claymont Steel site, and all of the others, all of the other 14 sites. And that remediation is taking place either under the auspices of DENREC or the EPA. But the criticism of it is that it's often what they call cap and contain. So the idea is that this is a means of controlling or remediating the contamination on any particular site. That essentially buries the contamination, and what it doesn't allow for is disturbance of whatever the toxic material is, either by future development or possibly even by sea level rise.
And this is a big part of this pitch, that these sites are largely what are called brownfield sites that have been previously used by industry, perhaps contaminated by them, now dormant, and they're really expensive for the state to remediate. So, hey, why not let businesses do it for us? And your piece indicates at least some environmental groups are willing to make that trade-off as long as no new CZA land is opened up to industry.
Well, that's right. I mean, I had a conversation with the Nature Conservancy, and they said, and this was in a statement before the detail of the bill became known, that they were in favor of the principle of cleaning up these sites, doing a thorough job of that using private money that would come from the business community.
And you also note that there's some additional protections in place if this bill gets passed. Should a new owner have to back out once they kind of start into the process?
Well, that's right. I mean, what the bill's language refers to what they call a financial surety, so that any further remediation process that begins under the auspices of some investor would continue if that investor had to pull out for whatever reason.
You also mentioned just a minute ago sea level rise, and there's also a provision addressing that in this bill. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, of course, Delaware, of course, is exceptionally vulnerable to rising seas, as we've been hearing for some years now. And of course, all of these 14 sites are in the coastal zone. And so what the bill is calling for, one of the conditions that it would impose on redevelopers of these sites is for the developer to present a sea level rise plan, and essentially what that would do is to establish the site's resilience against rising seas, they would need to show that the site would not be affected by flooding, and that things like tanks would be resilient to those things.
And despite some of these provisions that we've talked about, it seems aimed at getting support from environmental groups. Some of those environmental groups remain staunchly opposed to any type of changes to the Coastal Zone Act. What's their argument?
Well, they simply say that the return of heavy industry to coastal areas would renew a threat to air quality and water quality, which was the original intent of the act was to preserve those things so that the natural environment and tourism and recreation could be protected.
You mentioned that some of the bill's proponents in the business community would like to have seen more sites opened up. Is there any concern from the opponents that this is just kind of a first step toward a larger effort to dismantle the Coastal Zone Act?
Well, it's clear that the business community wanted the bill to include more. More sites. They weren't specific about how many more sites they wanted to see, but it was notable. I had a conversation with a representative of the Delaware State Chamber of Commerce, who I was asking him for responses to the bill, and he sounded kind of lukewarm about it. He referred to it as a good first step, said that he would like to have seen more sites, and said he would that the business community would also like to see a streamlined process for appeals, and the other point to note here is that the legislative backers of this bill were clearly under pressure from the business community. Representative Ed Osinski, who is the prime mover here on the House side, made it very clear in my conversations with him that he was under pressure from business to add further sites to his list of 14, but he simply wasn't going to do that, he was very emphatic that he wanted to strike this balance between the economy and the environment.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, do we know, is there any indication that there's a lot of interest in these sites, that if you open up all 14 of them or even more, that developers would flock to them?
Well, it's unclear. I had a conversation with one attorney who represents two potential owners of two sites, and he claimed that there was a great deal of interest. He wasn't specific about that. What people have said in the past is that the existence of the Coastal Zone Act has been a significant disincentive to the business community to invest in these areas.
So having talked to lawmakers and people on both sides of this issue, do you feel like it has the support it needs to get through? What's your sense of that?
Well, I think it's right now unclear. Of course, Representative Osinski and his colleagues, they express confidence that the bill will eventually become law, although Representative Osinski himself it does acknowledge, as the governor said, that this is going to be a pretty heavy lift. As of today, May 25th, there were 19 co-sponsors, three times as many Republicans as there were Democrats. And Mr. Osinski does say that he acknowledges that there's going to be pushback, especially from the environmental community. I spoke with one Democrat who was he said he was likely to vote against the bill. He doesn't believe that the investment community is prepared to spend the vast amounts of money that is necessary to clean up these sites to the higher standard that would be required by the bill. And he was particularly dismissive about the inclusion of these bulk transfer facilities. There would be 9 bulk transfer facilities in this. Allowed under the Act, and he dismissed the idea that those in themselves would create jobs. So on balance, Tom, I think it is in the balance now.
All right, John Hurdle, we thank you for taking time and joining us this week on The Green.
Thank you.
And remember, you can read John's piece on the Coastal Zone Act and potential changes right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We head to Wilmington next to look at the state of city-based charter schools. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Charter schools have been back in the headlines recently. Last week, Delaware's House of Representatives approved a bill that would end charters' use of a 5-mile radius surrounding their location as an enrollment preference. Instead, under the bill, a charter would be able to use the school district in which it resides as an enrollment preference. But the bill explicitly excludes the part of the Christina School District within the city of Wilmington, which critics say lets Newark Charter continue to avoid enrolling poor minority city students. Charter advocates say there are city charter schools that can and do serve those Wilmington students. So how are those city charters doing, and has their location in the city proven beneficial? These are questions we asked contributor Larry Nagengast to look into before this latest bill put charters back in the headlines. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to talk about it.
Well, city charters often open, Larry, with great fanfare, high expectations, but the results have kind of been a mixed bag. A couple, Delaware Met, Moyer, have failed. Academia Antonio Alonso left the city for the suburbs. But a handful do remain and seem on track. Is there a common thread that runs through those still standing, or have they simply been able to carve out constituencies that work?
Well, there are currently 4 charter schools operating in downtown Wilmington, all of them just a couple of blocks from Rodney Square. 3 of them are just completing their second year, and all of those appear to be off to good starts. Yes, there is a common thread, and that thread is that each school is based on a solid curriculum model. Great Oaks Charter, affiliated with similarly named charters in New York City, Newark, New Jersey, and Bridgeport, Connecticut, has a schedule that incorporates more than an hour and a half each day of one-on-one tutoring in English and math for every student. Freire, modeled after a successful program in Philadelphia, gives its students 2 periods of math and English a day in 9th and 11th grade. First State Montessori, well, that's a Montessori program, and that's one that's recognized worldwide for excellence in individualizing educational exploration.
And then there's Kumba, which has kind of established itself as somewhat the gold standard for making a city charter work, at least here in Wilmington. They've been around since 2001. They've expanded, they've moved, and they still serve a predominantly minority and low-income student body. That's a pretty impressive resume. How do they make it work?
Well, yeah, you spelled it out pretty well. The school struggled in its early years, but its leaders persisted. The quality of instruction improved, and its students have demonstrated respectable performance in the various statewide assessment programs over the past decade. And that's something you don't often see in schools whose demographic is 98% African American and Latino and 85% low income. One of the keys here is something that I've noted on other occasions about charter schools. Parents have to fill out an application to get their child into a charter rather than just sending them where their feeder pattern dictates. Parents who take extra steps tend to get more involved, and that is often a positive in their children's education.
And that also may be somewhat of the common thread that some of these schools in the city, like First Aid Montessori, Great Oaks, Freire, they do seem to emphasize, like Kumba, that parental engagement piece.
Yes, the more parental engagement, the better, and certainly all of the school officials that I've spoken to have said that. I know there have been some charters that I've spoken to in years past who said, no, that it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference in terms of parental involvement, but certainly the ones in the city, they're saying that, yes, it absolutely does.
Kumba is one of the two charters that is in the Community Education Building, the former MBNA, Bank of America office high-rise that was donated with the intention of creating a charter hub downtown. That has not panned out quite as expected. Where does it stand now, and what are those running it saying about its future?
The building's operators are trying, but I'm certainly skeptical about whether they'll achieve their goal of hosting four schools with a total of enrollment of more than 2,400 students in the next few years. Kumba has maxed out at 745 students. Great Oaks has 5 years of expansion ahead of it before it reaches its cap of 750 to 800. Academia Antonio Alonso, a dual language elementary program, left the building last year to move to the suburbs. So there's room for one or two more schools in the high rise, but there are no pending applications for new charters in the state. The Community Education Building team is also quite selective about its schools. It wants operators who can deliver high performance for students, but even they admit that their plush building is not the perfect setting for every school.
And I guess that kind of begs the question, were they just a little bit perhaps too optimistic about what they could do in a downtown setting?
I'm going to say yes, yes, that's the answer. It was an MBNA building. It was the Longwood Foundation, the largest foundation in the state, that engineered the acquisition and the transformation of the building. These are folks that are accustomed to thinking big in this environment. They're used to being able to get things done, they may be a little bit out of their league again in terms of going in and trying to set up a building with four charter schools and to do it phasing it in even over 3 or 4 years. I think they were expecting and trying to do too much too soon.
Let's talk a little bit more about this concept of city charter schools and being in the city. One of the things that all the city charters that have launched touted when they opened was the opportunities that being in the city would create for their students. Has that panned out for these ones that have remained standing?
Absolutely. It has. But maybe not to as great an extent as you might think. I mean, yeah, the kids get to venture out into Rodney Square, especially when there are festivals and special activities. Montessori and Kumba students hold dance lessons at the Grand Opera House. Montessori students visit the Wilmington Library regularly. Some Great Oak students have performed at the Queen. They visited the Kalmar Nichols Shipyard. So, yeah, there are plenty of opportunities there. But then when you think about it, if you're taking your kids to the library because you don't have a library in your own building, well, what does that say? I mean, it might be a prudent use of resources not to put a library in your school when there is one right around the corner. But that's subject to some debate. So yeah, it's good that you get out, but all of these things might not be as wonderful as they seem. And I'm not putting them down, but it's something that you can talk about both ways.
And they have to be weighed against the challenges that being in the city creates. What have some of those challenges been for these charters, and how the schools that have remained and been relatively successful but overcome the challenges of being based in the city?
Well, yeah, similar situation here. The kids in the Community Education Building, there's no gym there, so they've got to go to the Walnut Street Y for their phys ed classes. There's no big playground area there, so the youngsters at the lower grades at Kumba, they've got to walk a block and a half to a paved parking lot for recess periods. And these were a couple of the factors that were involved in Academia Antonio Alonso deciding that they wanted to move to the suburbs. Great Oaks is a middle school, transitioning into a middle school high school. They've got to have a growing need for athletic fields, and you don't find football fields downtown. Howard High School has the same situation. I mean, they've got to go over and play at Baynard Stadium, which is about maybe a mile away. But these are issues that city schools have to deal with. There are lots of trade-offs like that. The buildings that the charters are in weren't originally designed to be schools. Grassy play areas are hard to find in the middle of the city. So yeah, these are issues. Community Education Building is working to help Great Oaks and help Kumba find suitable sites for these activities, and will continue to do so. But it's not an easy fix, and it's not a quick fix. So you've got to realize that there are trade-offs if you choose to send your child to a school in Center City. There's some good things, and there are some things that you're not going to have in your typical suburban site.
When the state approved creating charters, they were built as these incubators that would try new ideas, then collaborate with other schools to bring those best ideas to all schools. How have these charters performed in doing that, collaborating either with each other or with other schools with some of the things that they've been working on and developing?
Well, one of the best examples goes back a couple of years when the Brandywine School District started using this Singapore math program for its elementary students after Kumba had a good deal of success using it. Other than that, there hasn't been a great deal of curriculum sharing between charters and districts or even among the charters themselves. We are seeing other forms of collaboration. Kumba is among a group of charters that developed and shared an alternate format for teacher evaluations. Kumba and Great Oaks, being in the same building, are partnering in teacher recruitment and professional training, and there are other aspects of sharing that are also going on through the Delaware Charter Schools Network.
The idea of collaborating and sharing best practices is also an issue that the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission has tried to focus on, despite its uncertain future. Has WEIC been able to make any progress in terms of building this collaborative piece for charter schools and other schools?
Well, WEIC does have what it calls a Charter District Collaboration Committee, and this group has spent 2 years going back and forth, and the first year was kind of rough and getting over some of this distrust. The second year was a little bit better, and they've gotten around to suggesting that the charters and the districts get together and do something that has taken place in about 20 other communities nationwide, signing a voluntary compact that identifies ways that charters and traditional schools can cooperate with each other. And they've listed a couple of areas that are ripe for consideration: partnering in teacher training, for example, coordinating kindergarten registrations. But there's really been very little talk outside of that commission framework about actually moving forward on any of these initiatives. So we're going to have to wait a while to see what happens with that.
And even beyond that, I mean, you mentioned that the kind of lingering mistrust. Is any progress often just undercut by that? We've seen it again in the charter bill currently before the General Assembly now regarding the 5-mile radius preference that has some arguing that this bill would shut city kids out of a high-achieving charter like Newark Charter. Is that perhaps the biggest issue here, is that mistrust and finding a way to mitigate it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this mistrust has been lingering, and it's the result of a system that has had the charters and the traditional schools competing with each other for more than 20 years. Charters get their funding based on how many kids they can attract out of the traditional school system, and the traditional schools complain that their planning becomes more difficult each year because they don't know how many kids the charters are going to take away from them. And then in some areas, and Newark Charter is certainly an example of this, there's some issues about are these schools not necessarily segregationist, but they don't have the same racial demographics as many of the traditional public schools. So there's that lingering concern as well. I didn't write about it this week, but this, you know, the Newark charter issue is worth a couple of quick comments. I mean, first of all, given Newark Charter's popularity, even kids living within 5 miles of the school still have to get picked in a lottery to get in. If you remove the 5 mile limit and you use the suburban part of the Christina district as a border for enrollment preference, that's going to make Newark Charter's pool larger, but it's not going to make admission any easier, and it's not going to have a significant impact on the school's demographics. However, if you write a new law and it excludes the Wilmington portion of Christina from Newark Charter's territory, that's virtually the same as what the state did with the 1968 Educational Advancement Act, when it included language that barred any merger of the old Wilmington school district with suburban districts. And that law was declared unconstitutional in the desegregation case in the 1970s. To me, it looks like this amendment to the charter law would have the same impact and could set up a court case with a significant constitutional issue. On the other hand, and there's always another hand, Wilmington parents have been complaining for years that they don't want younger kids bused to schools in Newark. And I bet that even if Newark Charter might be considered worth the trip, there won't be many who are really interested in applying and then taking the ride. So let me leave you with this closing suggestion then. Let's save the lawsuit by letting kids in the Wilmington section of Christina apply to Newark Charter, and at the same time, maybe we think about creating another charter in Wilmington that could serve the Christina kids who are now on the waiting list for Kumba and Montessori.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time and insight this week. Again, you can find his piece on city charter schools right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Our Megan Pauly sits down with Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer to delve into his plans to address vacant housing and the crime that often surrounds it. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Newcastle County recently announced it's taking new steps to address vacant housing. Last week, County Executive Matt Meyer signed legislation allowing the county to register vacant properties if the owner fails to register them and imposes additional penalties and fees for vacancy. It's part of a broader countywide strategy that includes prioritizing the rapid rehabilitation and resale of vacant properties, streamlining the sheriff sale process, and identifying opportunities to change state law in this area. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly sat down with County Executive Matt Meyer to discuss these efforts and what impact he hopes they'll have.
So vacant housing has been one of your priorities, addressing vacant housing. Tell me about the work that you've been able to do so far as county executive.
Well, I committed from day one to do whatever we can so that every community across our county is a safe one. The connection between vacant housing and problems in public safety is very clear. It's very clear here. In our county, it's very clear in our largest city, the city of Wilmington. Actually, it's very clear in Philadelphia and across the country. In Philadelphia, reports have shown that repairs to vacant housing resulted in a 19% decrease in assaults and nearly a 40% increase in gun assaults. So we actually created a map that looked at our concentration of vacant housing across the county. We layered over it our occurrences of violent crime, and they're almost all in the same places across the county. We believe it's a causal relationship, which means that an increase in vacant homes, an increase in vacancy, leads to community blight, which leads directly to increased criminal activity.
How many vacant homes right now in Newcastle County are there?
We believe in all of Newcastle County there are between 4,000 and 5,000. In unincorporated Newcastle County, areas that our Newcastle County Police operates, patrols in, it's over 1,300. Less than five vacant homes. The county has put less than five vacant homes through the sheriff's sale process in the last 4 years. We're trying to increase that to over 75, at least begin the process in the next 12 months. That's one of the elements of the policy that we recently announced.
Why were there so few homes going through the sheriff's sale process, to your knowledge?
I think government sometimes is not managed in the most efficient way. And so we're looking at every there. When you think about the sheriff sale process, can be complicated. You want to make sure there are buyers on the other side. You have to make sure you jump through a number of hoops and foreclosure. And there's a lot of legalities involved in putting a home through foreclosure. You have to actually know what you're doing and make every step correctly and legally. So we are looking at every single step and making sure that that happens. We're also looking for ways to get an increasing number of vacant homes into processes that will involve them being renovated. So, for example, Councilman Tackett, with the strong support of Councilman Penrose Hollins, and the overwhelming majority of council recently passed an ordinance that accelerates the process. It requires vacant housing registration. So if your home is vacant, if you have a home that's vacant for an extended period of time, you will now be required to register it with Newcastle County. If it stays vacant for an extended period of time, you pay increasing fines for that.
Do you have a sense of how many of the vacant homes, you know, are owned or have a homeowner living in Delaware who may just have kind of let it go? Or do you have a sense of kind of where the different properties are and the situation they're in?
We certainly have maps that show us where they are. And again, we have what our police call TAPS communities, targeted analytic policing communities, where we disproportionately target our policing resources because they're a little bit less safe than other neighborhoods. Our vacant housing concentrations are in all of those TAPS neighborhoods. So the idea is that we work together, and we're working collaboratively with HUD, which is a federal agency, with the state, which has actually two bills that will help us a lot, and of course with all departments of my government, our special services department, which deals with parks and sewers and buildings, Vince and the folks in housing in our community services unit, of course, the police, our land use department. All these different departments are coming together to make together with the state and the federal government to make a unified policy. We're working very effectively with community leaders, Sandra Smithers, who some call Mayor Smithers, of Dunleith, is integrally involved, as are Habitat for Humanity, Interfaith Community Housing, leading private nonprofit partners who we're collaborating with both to make the policy and to execute it. Nobody wants this in our communities, and so we're coming together to make a really smart policy and make sure it happens.
So tell me more about this recent announcement and how it fits with some of the state legislation.
So there are basically four pieces that we talked about principally at the announcement. One was this ordinance, which requires the registration of vacant housing. A second part is a bill that is proposed in Dover, hopefully will pass this year, that is an attempt to eliminate what we call bad actor purchasers. So at sheriff sale, it doesn't help us if you have a bad piece of property going to a new owner who's just interested in flipping the property and has a history of not paying bills and not keeping up a property. So it creates a registration process where for most people who want to go and buy a property at a sheriff's sale, who pay their taxes and do good work, they'll have no problem. But if you've had problems in the past, you may actually not have the ability to bid on some of these properties at sheriff's sale. So we're trying to really encourage high-quality landlords to high-quality owners to come to the sheriff's sales. And the third thing is, when there are fines levied against vacant properties, they basically can be a legal lien on the property. So they eventually will have to be paid, and that also could facilitate sheriff sales happening. The fourth thing is, as I mentioned, something that we're dealing with here within county government, and that is executing in a more efficient way on sheriff sales so that when there are vacant properties, there is blight in the neighborhood, we aggressively look at those vacant homes and we convert them into a private property that's renovated and that's actually, you know, a benefit to the community. We're calling the effort vacant spaces to beautiful places. Vacant spaces to beautiful places. The reason we're doing that is a lot of people look at vacant housing and blight and they see hopelessness. They see communities spiraling downward. We don't see it that way at all.
Thanks to Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer and our Megan Pauly for their time this week discussing efforts to tackle vacant housing in Newcastle County. And if you're among the many visitors to Rehoboth Beach each year that enjoy soaking in the sun on the beach, you'll find some changes this year when you stake out your spot in the sand. We'll explain next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As the summer season gets underway this Memorial Day weekend, beaches in the First State start to get pretty crowded again. To ease some of the congestion, Rehoboth Beach has banned tents and barbecues on the beach starting this summer. And while this may please some visitors, it's frustrating a few business owners who think tourists may take their gear and their wallets and head elsewhere. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison has the story.
Rehoboth Beach attracts 7 million visitors a year, mostly in summer. As people crowd this one-mile stretch of beach each year, stories like this one from local Mae Truman have become increasingly common. She was on the beach a couple years back when it started to get crowded.
There's a lady next to us, and she had an area and all, but she could see the beach, a nice view of the beach and everything. A family came in, and they squeezed in like a foot away from her, and they put a tent up right in front of her and her family.
And things get pretty hot on the beach when you block someone's view. The beach patrols had to break up numerous fights in recent years sparked by people using tents. And Rehoboth Beach Chamber of Commerce President Carol Everhart has started receiving complaints from visitors.
They came to relax, view the ocean, spread out their blanket, and with all of the equipment that was coming into the beach, they just couldn't do that.
The chamber estimates tourists spend, on average, $150 a day in Rehoboth. So Everhart worked with the city council to pass an ordinance that bans tents, canopies, and barbecues on the beach starting this summer. It's nearly identical to an ordinance passed by Myrtle Beach, South Carolina in 2015.
Anything that's negative that they say no to will drive people away. There's other beaches.
Jay Levy manages the Tidal Rave 5 and Dime on the boardwalk. It's one of those places that sells beach chairs and kitschy things like Batman shirts that actually say Buttman. He thinks the city council's hurting his business by overregulating the beach.
They listen to too much of the whining. This one whines, that one whines. Shut up and be happy that you have all these people coming down here, these wonderful families from Pennsylvania, Washington, and all over. Don't ruin it with stupidity.
But other businesses in town see an opportunity. Melissa Williams runs Sensations about a block down the beach. She's filling up canisters with umbrellas.
The one displayed in the window is just a 6-foot one.
Under this new ordinance, umbrellas are now the only shade game in town.
This one has a built-in anchor. It's right on the pole, which is really awesome because anchors are now part of the ordinance.
So you think that this year, since it is a new ordinance, people will come down to the beach with their canopies or tents and then realize they can't use them and then maybe come here and say, okay, I'm going to buy an umbrella now.
Yes, we even have the ordinance posted in the window for passersby.
Many business owners say it's too soon to know whether the tent ban will hurt sales. And so far, a lot of visitors we've talked to like the idea of keeping tents off the beach. The barbecue ban, however, could be a tougher sell, at least judging by this response from Peter Reitzman of Baldwinsville, New York.
So I can understand why they're doing it, for safety reasons, but I still think barbecuing is a tradition.
With this new ordinance, cold cuts may be the new tradition. James Morrison, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And we wrap up this week's edition of The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we'll meet some students who have the unique opportunity to send an experiment they concocted into space next month. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A team from Middletown's Everett Meredith Middle School is sending minnows into space. They're one of 11 teams whose experiment was selected as part of a national competition in which students design an experiment to test in Earth's orbit. Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus introduces us to the Everett Meredith Middle School team and its experiment in this week's Enlighten Me.
What happens if you launch minnows into space? Can they grow and survive in conditions where gravity is low and almost non-existent? These are some of the questions five Middletown students hope to answer when NASA launches a project they created from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida to the International Space Station June 1st. A few weeks ago, the seventh graders came together to pack their project and send it to Houston, where it will be prepped for the Florida launch on a SpaceX rocket.
I'm going to need you guys to measure out on our thing. It says we have 4 milliliters of spring water.
See, that's spring water.
So I need you to measure. We're doing both the ground truth and the space experiment. Okay. So we have to make two of them.
But it was a long road to get here, a road that started last school year.
My name is Meredith Swartzendruber, and I am an eighth grade science teacher. I have this extensive network of teachers around the country and even in Canada and Australia that I can reach out to for lesson ideas or programs to help get our students involved. And one of the lessons or one of the programs I wanted to learn about more was the Student Spaceflight Experiment Program.
A couple of years ago, Swartzendruber got the student body at her old school in Bear to participate in that national competition, and one team was selected to send its project, focused on fruit flies, into orbit. The Spaceflight Experiments Program is designed to have students at individual schools or school districts form groups that propose and design an experiment that could be launched into Earth's orbit. They're encouraged to get their hands dirty and think like professional scientists. Jeff Goldstein created the Student Spaceflight Experiments Program. He says, in a way, the program is preparing the next generation of scientists.
Hopefully some will be interested in going on into STEM careers. It would be nice if they go on to STEM careers that enable space exploration, but that's really not the goal. You know, if we can entice students to go on into medical research and do great things on the frontiers of medicine, we will have done a good job.
But there's a catch. Schools need to raise $23,000 to participate. That covers project materials, transporting the winning project to and from the International Space Station, and its four-week stay in orbit. Swartzendruber says she wrote grants and reached out to organizations, and the students sold candles. Once they met their goal, Everett Meredith Middle School developed nearly 100 project proposals. The top 20 were reviewed by a board of local scientists and engineers. That board picked 3 to send to the national competition, judged by a board at the Smithsonian. One stood out and is one of just 11 projects nationwide selected to go into space. The project: can fathead minnows grow and develop in a microgravity environment?
I always had a natural love for science. That was like my favorite thing to do. Every day when I was in elementary school, the only thing I was getting excited for was either math or science, because those were my two favorite subjects.
That's Noah Keller, one of Everett Meredith's budding young scientists and proud minnow parents. He says he wants to be a mechanical engineer when he grows up. Last year, Keller and his peers, Olivia Alessandrini, Kainat Azar, Olivia Court, and Mulai Anjai, had a class together. When they heard about the competition, they formed a group and started to think about what kind of proposal they could put together. Court says they spent a lot of time together.
Every day at lunch, we would go up to our science teacher's room and just plan and work on how we were going to do this. And I think on Tuesdays and Thursdays a lot, we could stay after school and work on this project. We stayed at school every single day we could, just working on this project.
A few ideas, including launching small insects or a taco rocket into space, got kicked around. Kainat Azar says the research wasn't easy. I'm curious about what sort of prep went into this. You guys were staying after school a lot.
We had this packet that our teacher gave us for directions to do it. We had to come up with an experiment, the results, and what we were actually going to do, why are we going to do it. Like, we had to write scientific grade papers.
Finally, they agreed to study minnows. Their project soared through various reviews, and in May 2016, the 5 students found out they won.
What was your reaction?
I found out first, and I called Olivia, and then she started screaming and yelling when she found out on the phone.
And what made you guys so excited about this?
Because we're only 12 years old, and we're sending something into space.
Once their project was picked, they gathered preliminary data and settled on the amount of materials they needed. They did additional research into minnows and went through a safety review with NASA. Then they waited. The launch was delayed several times, from last fall to winter to early spring, and now June 1st. Swartzendruber says that's the nature of space travel. Now with the launch date set, the project is finally becoming a reality. Their package is on its way with just the right amount of spring water, 6 minnow eggs, and 83 pallets of fish food. It also includes a chemical that will ultimately kill the fish and end the experiment before gravity has a chance to corrupt the results. Swartzendruber says if they didn't kill the fish before they left space, the fish might grow differently as they head back to Earth.
Where do we put the water after?
The water, you are going to insert it completely.
That side?
All the way through both clamps and squeeze and let it get all the way into the bottom tube. Okay?
No, I thought the fish go in that bottom one because it's
bigger. They have to go in the water.
If everything goes according to plan, their minnows will be in space next month, and while they're up there, the team will conduct a control version of the experiment in the classroom for comparison, giving the fish a little bit of food to see how they grow and develop. Then, just like the experiment in space, they'll release a chemical to end the fish's growth. The group isn't sure what to expect. Schwarzendruber says they've predicted the minnows will shrink or possibly become disfigured. But she adds whether they're right or wrong, it's been a great experience.
It gets me happy to think that they're so excited about their experiment and they're so excited about science and that they want to pursue something in science later in life. And I think that's just the best goal we can hope for.
Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie, for enlightening us this week. Only one of the students, Mulai Enjai, will actually be on hand for the launch next week. The others aren't able to make it, and we'll wait for Enjai's report back to them. And that'll do it for this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's James Morrison, Megan Pauly, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.